are almost entirely innocent of them, with only a couple of small exceptions. This is all the more remarkable when we note that from as early as Paul, the common creedal formula declared that the resurrection too was according to the scriptures, and Paul himself joins the rest of the early church in ransacking Psalms and prophets to find texts to explain what just happened and set it within, and as the climax too, the long story of God and Israel. Why do the gospel resurrection narratives not do the same? It would be easy for Matthew to refer to one or two scriptural prophecies that were being fulfilled, but he doesn't. John tells us that the disciples didn't yet know the scriptural teaching that the Messiah would rise again, but he doesn't quote the texts he has in mind. We could say, of course, that whoever wrote the stories in the form we now have them went through cunningly and took material out to make them look as if they were very old, rather like someone deliberately taking all the electric fittings out of a house to make it look like it might have done a century or more ago. The normal assumption among many scholars that the stories grew up in the second generation, as late, say, as the 80s or 90s, would require us to say that, though they interestingly embody, as we shall see, the theology of Paul, they have carefully extracted from that theology all the biblical allusions that are already so plentiful in a passage like 1 Corinthians chapter 15. That might be marginally plausible if we had just one account, or if the four accounts were obviously derived from one another. We don't, and they aren't. You either have to imagine four very different writers, each deciding to write up an Easter narrative based on the theology of the early church, but removing all the biblical echoes, and managing to do so in four very different, though theologically consistent ways, or you have to say, which I think is infinitely more probable, that the stories, even if they were written down a lot later, go back to very, very early oral tradition, which was formed and set firmly in the memory of different storytellers before there was any time for biblical reflection. The second strange feature of the stories is more often remarked upon, the presence of the women as the principal witnesses. Whether we like it or not, women were not regarded as credible witnesses in the ancient world. When the tradition had time to sort itself out and acquire the fixed form we already find in Paul's quotation of it in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the women were quietly dropped. They were apologetically embarrassing. But there they are, in all four gospel stories, front and center, the first witnesses, the first apostles. Nobody would have made them up. Had the tradition started in the male-only form we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, it would never have developed in such different ways as well into the female-first stories we find in the Gospels. The third strange feature is the portrait of Jesus himself. If, as many revisionists have tried to make out, the Gospel stories developed either from people mulling over the scriptures or from an experience of inner subjective illumination, the one thing you would expect to find is the risen Jesus shining like a star. That's what Daniel says will happen. That's what an experience of inner illumination might have generated. We have such an account in the Transfiguration. But none of the Gospels say this about Jesus at Easter. Indeed, he appears as a human being, with a body that in some ways is quite normal, and can be mistaken for a gardener or a fellow traveller on the road. Yet the stories also contain, and this marks them out as among the most mysterious stories ever written, definite signs that this body has been transformed. It is clearly physical. It uses up, so to speak, the matter of the crucified body, hence the empty tomb. But equally it comes and goes through locked doors. It is not always recognized, and in the end it disappears into God's space, that is, heaven, through the thin curtain that in much Jewish thought separates God's space from human space. This kind of account is without precedent. No biblical texts predict that the resurrection will involve this kind of body. No speculative theology had laid this trail for the evangelists to follow, and to follow, we note once more, in interestingly different ways. In particular, This should put a stop to the old nonsense that Luke's and John's accounts, which are the most apparently physical, were written late in the first century in an attempt to combat Docetism, the view that Jesus wasn't a real human being but only seemed to be so. Granted, if all you had was Jesus eating broiled fish, Luke, and inviting Thomas to touch him, John, such an account might have some initial plausibility. But if Luke and John were simply constructing narratives to combat Docetism, they surely shot themselves in the foot with both barrels when they spoke of the risen Jesus appearing through locked doors, disappearing again, sometimes being recognized, sometimes not, and finally ascending into heaven. The fourth strange feature of the resurrection accounts is the fact that they never mention the future Christian hope. Almost everywhere else in the New Testament, the resurrection of Jesus is spoken of in connection with the final hope that those who belong to Jesus will one day be raised as he has been, adding that this must be anticipated in the present, in baptism and behavior. Despite 1,000 Easter hymns and 1,000,000 Easter sermons, the resurrection narratives in the Gospels never, ever say anything like, Jesus is raised, therefore there is life after death, let alone, Jesus is raised, therefore we shall go to heaven when we die. Nor even, in a more authentic first century Christian way, do they say, Jesus is raised, therefore we shall be raised from the dead after the sleep of death. No. Insofar as the event is interpreted, Easter has a very this-worldly, present-age meaning. Jesus is raised, so he is the Messiah, and therefore he is the world's true Lord. Jesus is raised, so God's new creation has begun, and we, his followers, have a job to do. Jesus is raised, so we must act as his heralds, announcing his lordship to the entire world, making his kingdom come on earth as in heaven. To be sure, as early as Paul, the resurrection of Jesus is firmly linked to the final resurrection of all God's people. Had the stories been invented toward the end of the first century, they would certainly have included a mention of the final resurrection of all God's people. They don't, because they weren't. There is much more to say about the gospel resurrection narratives, but I conclude this first section of the chapter with the proposal that it is far, far easier to believe that the stories are essentially very early, pre-Pauline, and have not been substantially altered, except for light personal polishing, in subsequent transmission or editing. Yes, they show signs of the theological interests of the different evangelists. Matthew's story of the resurrection emphasizes typically Matthean themes, and so on. But this is like what you get when different artists paint portraits of the same person. This painting is certainly a Rembrandt, that is indubitably a Holbein. The touch of the individual artist is unmistakable, and yet the sitter is fully recognizable. The artists have not changed the color of her hair, the shape of his nose, the particular half-smile. And when we ask why such stories, so different in many ways and yet so interestingly consistent in these and other features, could have come into existence so early, all the early Christians give the obvious answer. Something like this is what happened, even though it was hard to describe at the time and remains mind-boggling thereafter. The stories, though lightly edited and written down later, are basically very, very early. They are not, as has so often been suggested, legends written up much later to give a pseudo-historical basis for what essentially was a private, interior experience. This, then, is the more or less universal witness of the early Christians, that they are who they are, they do what they do, they tell the stories they tell, not because of a new religious experience or insight, but because of something that happened. Something that happened to the crucified Jesus, something that they at once interpreted as meaning that he was, after all, the Messiah, that God's new age had, after all, broken into the present time, and that they were charged with a new commission, something that made them reaffirm the Jewish belief in resurrection, not swap it for a pagan alternative, but introduce several distinctive but consistent modifications within it. It is now time to ask, in the second section of this chapter, what can the historian say about all this? Easter and history. I begin with what I regard as fixed historical points. The only way we can explain the phenomena we have been examining is by proposing a two-pronged hypothesis. First, Jesus' tomb really was empty. Second, the disciples really did encounter him in ways that convinced them that he was not simply a ghost or hallucination. A brief word about each of these. If the disciples simply saw, or thought they saw, someone they took to be Jesus, that would not by itself have generated the stories we have. Everyone in the ancient world took it for granted that people sometimes had strange experiences involving encounters with the dead, particularly the recently dead. They knew at least as much as we do about such visions, about ghosts and dreams, and the fact that such things often occurred within the context of bereavement or grief. They had language for this, and it wasn't resurrection. However many such visions they'd had, they wouldn't have said Jesus was raised from the dead. They weren't expecting such a resurrection. In any case, a point people often ignore or conveniently forget, Jesus was buried according to a particular Jewish tradition, which was designed to occur in two stages. First, you carefully wrapped up the body with spices and linen and placed it on a shelf in a cave. Then, when the flesh had decomposed, hence the spices because of the smell, since the cave would be used for more than one corpse, you would collect the bones, fold them up reverently, and store them in a bone box, an ossuary. If Jesus had not been raised, then sooner or later someone would have had to go and collect his bones, fold them up, and store them. If anyone suggested that he had been raised from the dead, the bones in the tomb would be enough to disprove the suggestion. Nobody in the Jewish world would have spoken of such a person being already raised from the dead. Thus, without the empty tomb, the disciples would have been as quick to say hallucination as we would. Apparent meetings with Jesus would have been dismissed. You've obviously seen a ghost. Equally, an empty tomb by itself proves almost nothing. It might, as many have suggested, have been the wrong tomb, though a quick check would have sorted that one out. Someone, the soldiers, the gardeners, the chief priests, other disciples, or someone else, might have taken away the body for some reason or other. Grave robbery was well known. That was the conclusion Mary drew in John's Gospel. They've taken him away. And perhaps it was the gardener that did it. That was the conclusion the Jewish leaders broadcast, according to Matthew. His disciples took him away. All sorts of similar explanations could have been offered, and would have been, had not the empty tomb been accompanied by sightings of and meetings with Jesus himself. No. In order to explain historically how all the early Christians came to the belief they held that Jesus had been raised, we have to say at least this, that the tomb was empty, except for some grave clothes, and that they really did see and talk with someone who gave every appearance of being a solidly physical Jesus, though a Jesus who was strangely changed, more strangely than they were able fully to describe. Both the meetings and the empty tomb are therefore necessary if we are to explain the rise of the belief and the writing of the stories as we have them. Neither by itself was sufficient. Put them together, though, and they provide a complete and coherent explanation for the rise of the early Christian belief. Is there an alternative explanation? One that would get us off the hook of saying that the ancient pagan view, resurrection is impossible, along with its modern equivalents, was wrong? No. Like everything else in this chapter, the answer could be spelled out at much greater length, but we must at least note that the main alternative accounts, the revisionist proposals, lack all explanatory power. Take the phenomenon of cognitive dissonance, about which much has been written in the last half century or so. Cognitive dissonance is what happens when people who badly want something to be true, but are faced with strong evidence to the contrary, manage to leap over the data that point the wrong way and become even more strident in announcing their claims. This theory has some initial plausibility. There are some interesting examples of people behaving in this way, but theories like this will not serve as an explanation of the early Christian phenomena. In fact, the research on which the theory was originally based was already deeply flawed, as I have shown elsewhere. But, more particularly, it simply doesn't fit the state of affairs at Easter. The disciples were emphatically not expecting Jesus to be raised from the dead, all by himself in the middle of history. The fact that they were Second Temple Jews, and that resurrection was, as some have said, an idea that was in the air, simply won't account for the radical modifications they made in the Jewish belief, or for the astonishing features of the Easter stories themselves. In the same way, some have suggested that the early disciples had a new experience of grace, that they felt forgiven in a new way, that they had come to a new faith in the power of God, a new conviction that God's kingdom project was still going ahead despite Jesus' death. But this too simply won't work. As we saw earlier, to say that one had a new experience of grace doesn't take you one step nearer to saying that the leader you followed had been raised from the dead. The resurrection did indeed function as metaphor, but not as metaphor for a new religious experience. Judaism already had a rich language for that. Saying he's been raised from the dead, if he wasn't, is simply inexplicable historically. I am reminded of John Updike's trenchant poem, "Let us not mock God with metaphor, analogy, sidestepping, transcendence, making of the event a parable, a sign painted in the faded credulity of earlier ages. Let us walk through the door. Let us not seek to make it less monstrous for our own convenience, our own sense of beauty, lest, awakened in one unthinkable hour, we are embarrassed by the miracle and crushed by remonstrance." Many smaller arguments might be brought in at this point that we can only summarize. To begin with, here are other proposals regularly advanced as rival explanations to the early Christian one. 1. Jesus didn't really die. Someone gave him a drug that made him look like dead, and he revived in the tomb. Answer: Roman soldiers knew how to kill people, and no disciple would have been fooled by a half-drugged, beat-up Jesus into thinking he'd defeated death and inaugurated the kingdom. 2. When the women went to the tomb, they met someone else, perhaps James, Jesus' brother, who looked like him, and in the half-light they thought it was Jesus himself. Answer: They would have noticed soon enough. 3. Jesus only appeared to people who believed in him. Answer: The accounts make it clear that Thomas and Paul do not belong to this category, and actually none of Jesus' followers believed, after his death, that he really was the Messiah, let alone that he was in any sense divine. 4. The accounts we have are biased. Answer: So is all history, all journalism. Every photo is taken by somebody from some angle. 5. They began by saying he will be raised, as people had done of the martyrs, and this quickly passed into saying he has been raised, which was functionally equivalent. Answer: No, it wasn't. 6. Lots of people have visions of someone they love who has just died. This was what happened to the disciples. Answer: They knew perfectly well about things like that, and they had language for it. They would say, it's his angel, or it's his spirit, or his ghost. They wouldn't say, he's been raised from the dead. 7. Perhaps the most popular. What actually happened was that they had some kind of rich spiritual experience, which they interpreted through Jewish categories. Jesus, after all, really was alive, spiritually, and they were still in touch with him. Answer: That is simply a description of a noble death followed by a platonic immortality. Resurrection was and is the defeat of death, not simply a nicer description of it. And it's something that happens some while after the moment of death, not immediately. Equally, we may just notice 3 of the many small-scale arguments that are often, and quite rightly, advanced to support the belief that Jesus did indeed rise from the dead. One, Jewish tombs, especially those of martyrs, were venerated and often became shrines. There is no sign whatever of that having happened with Jesus' grave. Two, the early church's emphasis on the first day of the week as their special day is very hard to explain unless something striking really did happen then. A gradual or even sudden dawning of faith is hardly sufficient to explain it. Three, the disciples were hardly likely to go out and suffer and die for a belief that wasn't firmly anchored in fact. This is an important point. Though subject to the weakness that they might have been genuinely mistaken, they believed the resurrection of Jesus to be a fact, and they acted on that belief, but we know, so it would be said, that they were wrong. All this brings us face to face with the ultimate question. The empty tomb and the meetings with Jesus are as well established by the arguments I have advanced as any historical data could expect to be. They are, in combination, the only possible explanation for the stories and beliefs that grew up so quickly among Jesus' followers. How, in turn, do we explain them? In any other historical inquiry, the answer would be so obvious that it would hardly need saying. Here, of course, this obvious answer, well, it actually happened, is so shocking, so earth-shattering, that we rightly pause before leaping into the unknown. And here indeed, as some skeptical friends have cheerfully pointed out to me, it is always possible for anyone to follow the argument so far and to say simply, I don't have a good explanation for what happened to cause the empty tomb and the appearances, but I choose to maintain my belief that dead people don't rise, and therefore conclude that something else must have happened, even though we can't tell what it was. That is fine. I respect that position, but I simply note that it is indeed then a matter of choice, not a matter of saying that something called scientific historiography forces us to take that route. But, at this moment in the argument, all the signposts are pointing in one direction. I and others have studied quite extensively all the alternative explanations, ancient and modern, for the rise of the early church and the shape of its belief. Far and away the best historical explanation is that Jesus of Nazareth, having been thoroughly dead and buried, really was raised to life on the third day with a renewed body, not a mere resuscitated corpse, as people sometimes dismissively say, a new kind of physical body, which left an empty tomb behind it because it had used up the material of Jesus' original body, and which possessed new properties that nobody had expected or imagined, but that generated significant mutations in the thinking of those who encountered it. If something like this happened, it would perfectly explain why Christianity began and why it took the shape it did. But this is where I want to heed carefully the warnings of theologians who caution against any attempt to stand on the ground of rationalism and try to prove, in a mathematical fashion, something that, if it happened, ought to be regarded as the center not only of history, but also of epistemology, not only of what we know, but also of how we know it. I do not claim, in other words, that I have hereby proved the resurrection in terms of some neutral standpoint. I am offering, rather, a historical challenge to other explanations and to the worldviews within which they gain their meaning. Precisely because at this point we are faced with worldview-level issues, there is no neutral ground, no island in the middle of the epistemological ocean as yet uncolonized by any of the warring continents. Historical argument alone cannot force anyone to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, but historical argument is remarkably good at clearing away the undergrowth behind which skepticisms of various sorts have long been hiding. The proposal that Jesus was bodily raised from the dead possesses unrivaled power to explain the historical data at the heart of early Christianity. The obvious fact that this remains hugely challenging at the personal and corporate level ought not to put us off from taking it seriously. Or were we only playing when we entertained the question in the first place? There are, after all, different types of knowing. Science studies the repeatable, history studies the unrepeatable. Caesar only crossed the Rubicon once, and if he'd crossed it again, it would have meant something different the second time. There was and could be only one first landing on the moon. The fall of the Second Jerusalem Temple took place in AD 70 and never happened again. Historians don't, of course, see this as a problem, and are usually not shy about declaring that these events certainly took place, even though we can't repeat them in the laboratory. But when people say, "But that can't have happened because we know that that sort of thing doesn't actually happen," they are appealing to a would-be scientific principle of history, namely the principle of analogy. The problem with analogy is that it never quite gets you far enough. History is full of unlikely things that happened once and once only, with the result that the analogies are often at best partial. In any case, if someone declares that certain kinds of events don't normally happen, that merely invites the retort, "Who says?" And indeed, in the case in point, we should note as an obvious but often overlooked point the fact that the early Christians did not think that Jesus' resurrection was one instance of something that happened from time to time elsewhere. Granted, they saw it as the first advance instance of something that would eventually happen to everyone else, but they didn't employ that future hope as an analogy from which to argue backward that it had happened already in this one instance. It's going to happen to everyone eventually, so that shows it's all right for it to have happened this once in advance. So how does the historian work when the evidence points toward things that we do not normally expect? The resurrection is such a prime example of this that it's hard to produce, at this meta-level, analogies for the question itself. But sooner or later, questions of worldview begin to loom in the background, and the question of what kinds of material the historian will allow on stage is inevitably affected by the worldview within which he or she lives. And at that point, we are back to the question of the scientist who, faced with the thoroughly repeatable experiment of what happens to dead bodies, what has always, it seems, happened, and what seems likely always to go on happening, declares that the evidence is so massive that it is impossible to believe in the resurrection without ceasing to be a scientist altogether. But how far does that scientific position go? When we ask what a scientist can believe about something, we are asking a two-level question. First, we are asking about what sort of things the scientific method can explore, and how it can know or believe certain things. Second, we are asking about the kind of commitment someone wedded to scientific knowing is expected to have in all other areas of his or her life. Is a scientist, for example, expected to have a scientific approach to listening to music, to watching a football game, to falling in love? The question of whether a scientist can believe in Jesus' resurrection assumes, I think, that the resurrection, and perhaps particularly the resurrection of Jesus, is something that might be expected to impinge on the scientist's area of concern, somewhat as if one were to ask, "Can a scientist believe that the sun could rise twice in a day?" Or, "Can a scientist believe that a moth could fly to the moon?" This is different, in other words, from asking, "Can a scientist believe that Schubert's music is beautiful?" Or, "Can a scientist believe that her husband loves her?" There are those, of course, who by redefining the resurrection as simply a spiritual experience in the inner hearts and minds of the disciples, pull the question toward the latter pair and away from the former. But that is ruled out by what, as we shall see, all first-century users of the language of resurrection meant by the word. Resurrection, in the first century, meant someone physically, thoroughly dead, becoming physically, thoroughly alive again, not simply surviving or entering a purely spiritual world, whatever that might be. Resurrection, therefore, necessarily impinges on the public world. But at this point we meet a third element in knowing, a puzzling area beyond science, which knows what in principle can be repeated in a laboratory. And the kind of history that claims to know what makes sense by analogy with our own experience. Sometimes human beings, individuals or communities, are confronted with something that they must reject outright, or that, if they accept it, will demand the remaking of their worldview. To make this point, I once imagined a fantasy Oxbridge scenario. A rich old member gives to a college a wonderful, glorious painting that simply won't fit any of the spaces available in the college, and that is so magnificent that eventually the college decides to pull itself down and rebuild itself around this great and unexpected gift, discovering as it does so that all the best things about the college are thereby enhanced within the new structure, and all the problems of which people had been aware are thereby dealt with. And the key thing about that illustration, inadequate though it is that there must be some point at which the painting is received by the existing college, some epistemological point of overlap, to enable the college officers to make their momentous decision. The donor doesn't just come along, blow up the college unasked, present the painting and then say, "Now figure out what to do." My point is that the resurrection of Jesus, presenting itself as the obvious answer to the question, "How do you explain the rise of early Christianity?" has that kind of purchase on serious historical inquiry, and therefore poses that kind of challenge to the larger world view of both the historian and the scientist. The challenge is in fact the challenge of new creation. To put it at its most basic, the resurrection of Jesus offers itself to the student of history or science, no less than the Christian or the theologian, not as an odd event within the world as it is, but as the utterly characteristic, prototypical and foundational event within the world as it has begun to be. It is not an absurd event within the old world, but the symbol and starting point of the new world. The claim advanced in Christianity is of that magnitude. Jesus of Nazareth ushers in not simply a new religious possibility, not simply a new ethic or a new way of salvation, but a new creation. Now that might seem to be an epistemological as well as a theological preemptive strike. If a new creation is really on the loose, the historian wouldn't have any analogies for it, and the scientist wouldn't be able to consider its characteristic events in the light of other events that might otherwise have been open to inspection. What are we to do? History alone, certainly as conceived within the modern Western world and placed on the Procrustean bed of science, which, rightly, observes the world as it is, appears to leave us, like the children of Israel, waiting in fear on the shore of the Red Sea. Behind are the forces of skepticism, Pharaoh's hordes mocking and shouting that they're coming to get us. Ahead is the sea, representing chaos and death, forces that nobody else has ever claimed were beaten. What are we to do? There is no way back. No other explanations have been offered. In 2,000 years of sneering skepticism toward the Christian witness that can satisfactorily account for how the tomb came to be empty, how the disciples came to see Jesus, and how their lives and worldviews were transformed. The alternative accounts are actually remarkably thin. I've read most of the current ones, and many of them are laughable. History appears to leave us shivering on the shore. It can press the question to which Christian faith is the answer. But if someone chooses to stay between Pharaoh and the deep sea, history itself cannot force them further. Everything then depends on the context within which the history is considered. The most important decisions we make in life are not made by post-enlightenment, left-brain rationality alone. I do not suggest that one can argue right up to the central truth of Christian faith by pure human reason, building on simple observation of the world. Indeed, it should be obvious that that is impossible. Equally, I would not suggest that historical investigation of this sort has therefore no part to play, and that all that is required is a blind leap of faith. God has given us minds to think. The question has been appropriately raised. Christianity appeals to history, and to history it must go. And the question of Jesus' resurrection, though it may in some senses burst the boundaries of history, also remains within them. That is precisely why it is so important, so disturbing, so life and death. We could cope, the world could cope with a Jesus who ultimately remains a wonderful idea inside his disciples' minds and hearts, the world cannot cope with a Jesus who comes out of the tomb, who inaugurates God's new creation right in the middle of the old one. That is why, for a complete approach to the question, we need to locate our study of history within a larger complex of human, both personal and corporate, contexts. This, of course, forms a challenge not only to the historian and not only to the scientist, but also to all humans in whatever worldview they habitually live. Worldview issues are at stake here and cannot be dealt with by the old liberal strategy of pretending, as some reviewers of my earlier work have suggested, that to believe in the resurrection of Jesus is impossible for those who accept what one writer has called current paradigms of reality. If this means capitulating before the worldview of Hume and other Enlightenment thinkers, I reply that precisely now, in the early 21st century, there are all kinds of reasons for questioning current paradigms. In any case, it is, as we have seen, wrong to imply that the choice is between an ancient worldview and a modern or even a postmodern one. The ancient worldview of Homer, Plato, Cicero, and the rest had no room for resurrection either. What is at stake is the clash between a worldview that allows for a God of creation and justice and worldviews that don't. I am aware that many people still today assume that faith lives in a private sphere, shutting itself off from history, lest history make unwelcome inroads. Meanwhile, many others view history as a closed chain of visible cause and effect, which is never open to anything new happening. What the Easter stories do, and what, I argue, the whole existence of the Church does, from the very first days onward, is to pose a huge question. We need to set our asking of that question, ultimately, in dialogue at least with the life of the community that believes the gospel and seeks by its life to live out its truth. We need to set it within the reading of the Scriptures, which, by their whole narrative, lay out the worldview within which it makes sense. We need to think it through within a context of personal openness to the God of whom the Bible speaks, the Creator of the world, not simply a divine presence within it, the God of justice and truth. These are not substitutes for historical inquiry or lame supplements to it. They are ways of opening the windows of mind and heart to see what really, after all, might be possible in God's world, the world not only of creation as it is, but also of new creation. History, I believe, brings us to the point where we are bound to say there really was an empty tomb and there really were sightings of Jesus, the same and yet transformed. History then says, so how do you explain that? It offers us no easy escapes at that point, no quick side exits to the question. They've all been tried, and none of them work. History poses the question, and when Christian faith answers it, a sober, humble, questioning history, as opposed to an arrogant rationalism that has decided the issue in advance, may find itself saying, that sounds good to me. The story of Thomas in John chapter 20 will serve as a parable for this. Thomas, like a good historian, wants to see and touch. Jesus presents himself to his sight and invites him to touch. But Thomas doesn't. He transcends the type of knowing he had intended to use and passes into a higher and richer one. In the image I used before of Israel at the Red Sea, this is how it looks in words from the Easter Oratorio. Thomas begins with doubt. The sea is too deep, the heavens too high, I cannot swim, I cannot fly, I must stay here, I must stay here, here where I know how I can know, here where I know what I can know. Jesus then reappears and invites Thomas to see and touch. Suddenly the new, giddying possibility appears before him. The sea has parted, Pharaoh's hosts, despair and doubt and fear and pride no longer frighten us. We must cross over to the other side. The heaven bows down. with wounded hands, our exiled God, our Lord of shame, before us, living, breathing, stands. The word is near and calls our name. New knowing for the doubting mind, new seeing out of blindness grows, new trusting may the skeptic find, new hope through that which faith now knows. And with that, Thomas takes a deep breath and brings history and faith together in a rush. My Lord, he says, and my God. That is not an anti-historical statement. The Lord in question is precisely the one who is the climax of Israel's history and the launch of a new history. Once you grasp the resurrection, you see that Israel's history is full of partial and preparatory analogies for this moment. The epistemological weight is borne not simply by the promise of ultimate resurrection and new creation, but also by the narrative of God's mighty actions in the past. Nor is it an anti-scientific statement. The world of new creation is precisely the world of new creation. As such, it is open to, and indeed eager for, the work of human beings, not to manipulate it with magic tricks, nor to be subservient to it, as though the world of creation were itself divine, but to be its stewards. And stewards need to pay close, minute attention to that of which they are stewards, in order the better to serve it and to enable it to attain its intended fruitfulness. What I am suggesting is that faith in Jesus, risen from the dead, transcends but includes what we call history and what we call science. Faith of this sort is not blind belief, which rejects all history and science, nor is it simply, which would be much safer, a belief that inhabits a totally different sphere, discontinuous from either, in a separate, watertight compartment. Rather, this kind of faith, which, like all modes of knowledge, is defined by the nature of its object, is faith in the Creator God, the God who promised to put all things to rights at the last, the God who, as the sharp point where those two come together, raised Jesus from the dead within history, leaving evidence that demands an explanation from the scientist as well as anybody else. Insofar as I understand scientific method, when something turns up that doesn't fit the paradigm you're working with, one option at least, perhaps when all others have failed, is to change the paradigm, not to exclude everything you've known to that point, but to include it within a larger whole. That is, if you like, the Thomas challenge. If Thomas represents an epistemology of faith, which transcends but also includes historical and scientific knowing, we might suggest that Paul represents at this point an epistemology of hope. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, he sketches his argument that there will be a future resurrection as part of God's new creation, the redemption of the entire cosmos, as in Romans chapter 8. Hope for the Christian is not wishful thinking or mere blind optimism. It is a mode of knowing, a mode within which new things are possible, options are not shut down, new creation can happen. There is more to be said about this, but not here. All of which brings us to Peter. Epistemologies of faith and hope, both transcending and including historical and scientific knowing, point to an epistemology of love, an idea I first met in Bernard Lonergan, but that was hardly new with him. The story of John chapter 21 sharpens it up. Peter, famously, has denied Jesus. He has chosen to live within the normal world, where the tyrants win in the end, and where it's better to disassociate yourself from people who get on the wrong side of them. But now, with Easter, Peter is called to live in a new and different world, where Thomas is called to a new kind of faith, and Paul to a radically renewed hope. Peter is called to a new kind of love. Here I go back to Wittgenstein once more, not now for a poker, but for a famous and haunting aphorism. It is love that believes the resurrection. Simon, son of John, says Jesus, do you love me? There is a whole world in that question, a world of personal invitation and challenge, of the remaking of a human being after disloyalty and disaster, of the refashioning of epistemology itself, the question of how we know things to correspond to the new ontology, the question of what reality consists of. The reality that is the resurrection cannot simply be known from within the old world of decay and denial, of tyrants and torture, of disobedience and death. But that's the point. To repeat, the resurrection is not, as it were, a highly peculiar event within the present world, though it is that as well. It is principally the defining event of the new creation, the world that is being born with Jesus. If we are even to glimpse this new world, let alone enter it, we will need a different kind of knowing, a knowing that involves us in new ways, an epistemology that draws out from us not just the cool appraisal of detached quasi-scientific research, but also that whole-person engagement and involvement for which the best shorthand is love, in the full Johannine sense of agape. My sense, from talking to some scientific colleagues, is that, though it's hard to describe, something like this is already at work when the scientist devotes himself or herself to the subject matter so completely that the birth of new hypotheses comes about not so much through an abstract brain, a computer made of meat, crunching data, but through a soft and mysterious symbiosis of knower and known, of lover and beloved. The skeptic will at once suggest that this is a way of collapsing the truth of Easter once more into mere subjectivism. Not so. Just because it takes agape to believe the resurrection, that doesn't mean that all that happened was that Peter and the others felt their hearts strangely warmed. Precisely because it is love we are talking about, it must have a correlative reality in the world outside the lover. Love is the deepest mode of knowing because it is love that, while completely engaging with reality other than itself, affirms and celebrates that other-than-self reality. This is the point at which much modernist epistemology breaks down. The sterile antithesis of objective and subjective, where we say that things are either objectively true and can be perceived as such by a dispassionate observer, or subjectively true and so of no use as an account of the real public world, is overcome by the epistemology of love, which is called into being as the necessary mode of knowing for those who will live in the new public world, the world launched at Easter, the world in which Jesus is Lord and Caesar isn't. That is why, though the historical arguments for Jesus' bodily resurrection are truly strong, we must never suppose that they will do more than bring people to the questions faced by Thomas, Paul, and Peter, the questions of faith, hope, and love. We cannot use a supposedly objective historical epistemology as the ultimate ground for the truth of Easter. To do so would be like lighting a candle to see whether the sun had risen. What the candles of historical scholarship will do is to show that the room has been disturbed, that it doesn't look like it did last night, and that would-be normal explanations for this won't do. Maybe, we think after the historical arguments have done their work, maybe morning has come and the world has woken up. But to investigate whether this is so, we must take the risk and open the curtains to the rising sun. When we do so, we won't rely on the candles any more, not because we don't believe in evidence and argument, but because they will have been overtaken by the larger reality from which they borrow, to which they point, and in which they will find a new and larger home. All knowing is a gift from God, historical and scientific knowing no less than that of faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. Conclusion. One final note. I am convinced that the climate of skepticism, which for the last 200 years has made it unfashionable and even embarrassing to suggest that Jesus' resurrection really happened, was never and is not now itself a neutral thing, sociologically or politically. The intellectual coup d'etat by which the Enlightenment convinced so many that we now know that dead people don't rise, as though this was a modern discovery, rather than simply the reaffirmation of what Homer and Aeschylus had taken for granted, goes hand in hand with the Enlightenment's other proposals, not least that we have now come of age, that God can be kicked upstairs, that we can get on with running the world however we want to, carving it up to our advantage without outside interference. To that extent, the totalitarianisms of the last century were simply among the varied manifestations of a larger totalitarianism of thought and culture, against which postmodernity has now, and rightly in my view, rebelled. Who, after all, was it who didn't want the dead to be raised? Not simply the intellectually timid or the rationalists. It was, and is, those in power, the social and intellectual tyrants and bullies, the Caesars, who would be threatened by a lord of the world who had defeated the tyrant's last weapon, death itself, the Herods, who would be horrified at the post-mortem validation of the true king of the Jews. And this is the point where believing in the resurrection of Jesus suddenly ceases to be a matter of inquiring about an odd event in the first century and becomes a matter of rediscovering hope in the 21st century. Hope is what you get when you suddenly realize that a different worldview is possible, a worldview in which the rich, the powerful, and the unscrupulous do not, after all, have the last word. The same worldview shift that is demanded by the resurrection of Jesus is the shift that will enable us to transform the world. Think of Oscar Wilde's wonderful scene in his play Salome, when Herod hears reports that Jesus of Nazareth has been raising the dead. "I do not wish him to do that," says Herod. "I forbid him to do that. I allow no man to raise the dead. This man must be found and told that I forbid him to raise the dead." There is the bluster of the tyrant who knows his power is threatened, and I hear the same tone of voice not just in the politicians who want to carve up the world to their advantage, but also in the intellectual traditions that have gone along for the ride. But Wilde's next haunting line is the real crunch, for us as for Herod. "Where is this man?" demands Herod. "He is in every place, my lord," replies the courtier, "but it is hard to find him." Part 2. God's Future Plan. 5. Cosmic Future, Progress or Despair? Introduction. I suggested in the first part of the book that when we look at the contemporary world and church, we discover great confusion about future hope, but that when we look at the early Christians, we find not just faith, but a very precise and specific faith, both about Jesus and his resurrection, and about the future life that God had promised to all his people. This isn't a matter of ancient people being credulous and modern people being skeptical. There is a great deal of credulity in our present world, and there was a great deal of skepticism in the ancient world. It is rather something to do with the very specific worldview that was generated by the events concerning Jesus, and supremely the event of Easter itself. The early Christians looked back with joy to that great event, but precisely because of their very Jewish belief in God as the Creator and Redeemer, and because they had seen this belief confirmed in the totally unexpected event of Jesus' resurrection, they also looked forward eagerly to an event yet to come, in which what began at Easter would be completed. This larger picture of a still future renewal is the subject of the present part of the book. It would be possible at this point to jump right in and to speak of the personal hope that the gospel provides for each believer. What God did for Jesus on the first Easter day, he has promised to do for each one who is in Christ, each one indwelt by the Spirit of Christ. That is the biblical and historic Christian expectation in terms of ourselves as human beings. We shall come to this in due course. But there are good reasons for not starting there. In the last 200 years, Western thought has overemphasized the individual at the expense of the larger picture of God's creation. What is more, in much Western piety, at least since the Middle Ages, the influence of Greek philosophy has been very marked, resulting in a future expectation that bears far more resemblance to Plato's vision of souls entering into disembodied bliss than to the biblical picture of new heavens and new earth. If we start with the future hope of the individual, there is always the risk that we will, at least by implication, understand that as the real center of everything, and treat the hope of creation as mere embroidery around the edges. That has happened often enough. I am keen to rule it out by the structure of the argument, as well as through the detailed exposition. The order of the discussion is therefore determined by what seems to me the appropriate arrangement of the material. Instead of looking first at the promise to the individual and working up from that to the renewal of creation, we begin with the biblical vision of the future world, a vision of the present cosmos renewed from top to bottom by the God who is both creator and redeemer. That is the context within which we will then be able to speak of the second coming of Jesus and then of the bodily resurrection. We turn then to the large-scale hope of the whole cosmos, the great drama within which our little dramas are, as it were, the play within the play. What is God's purpose for the world as a whole? To answer this, we must first look in the present chapter at two very popular options before, in the next chapter, exploring the alternative that, though you'd never know it from much contemporary Christianity, is the one offered by the New Testament itself. Option 1. Evolutionary optimism. At the risk of gross oversimplification, we suggest that there are two quite different ways of looking at the future of the world. Both of these ways are sometimes confused with the Christian hope, and indeed both make use of some elements of the Christian hope in telling their grand stories. But neither comes anywhere near the picture we have in the New Testament, and, in flashes, in the Old. The Christian answer lies not so much halfway in between as in a biblical answer, which combines the strengths and eliminates the weaknesses of both. The first position is the myth of progress. Many people, particularly politicians and secular commentators in the press and elsewhere, still live by this myth, appeal to it, and encourage us to believe it. Indeed, if I may digress for a moment, the demise of serious political discourse today consists not least in this, that the politicians are still trying to whip up enthusiasm for their versions of this myth. It's the only discourse they know, poor things, while the rest of us have moved on. They are, to that extent, like people trying to row a boat toward the shore while the strong tide pulls them further and further out to sea. Because they face the wrong way, they can't see that their efforts are in vain, and they call out to other boats to join them in their splendid shore-bound voyage. That is why the relentlessly modernist and progressivist projects that the politicians feel obliged to offer us, a vote for us and things will get better, have to be dressed up with the relentlessly postmodernist techniques of spin and hype. In the absence of real hope, all that is left is feelings. Persuasion will not work, because we're never going to believe it. What we appear to need, and therefore what people give us, is entertainment. As a journalist said recently, our politicians demand to be treated like rock stars, while our rock stars are pretending to be politicians. Sorting out this mess, which the Christian hope, despite current opinion, is well suited to do, should mean, among many other things, a renewal of genuine political discourse, which God knows we badly need. But to return to our main theme, the myth of progress has deep roots in contemporary Western culture, and some of those roots are Christian. The idea that the human project, and indeed the cosmic project, could and would continue to grow and develop, producing unlimited human improvements and marching toward a utopia, goes back to the Renaissance, and was given its decisive push by the 18th century European Enlightenment. The full flowering of this belief took place in Europe in the 19th century, when the combination of scientific and economic advances on the one hand, and democratic freedoms and wider education on the other, produced a strong sense that history was accelerating toward a wonderful goal. El Dorado was just around the corner, the millennium in which the world would live at peace. Prosperity would spread out from enlightened Europe and America and embrace the world. By no means all thinkers 100 years ago fitted into this mould, but many, including some of enormous influence,